religious and spiritual traditions. And there are six chapters in here. Oh, more people. And let's see, the six chapters are, they're on the founding figures of six world religions and something about the traditions that they produced. I was recently thinking, it's kind of amazing that by and large religious traditions came from one particular person, in most cases men. One of my students in Merrillhurst College protested there were no women world spiritual teachers, and then I found out in the Native American tradition there is the Lakota white buffalo woman, and I proposed adding a chapter on that to my publisher, but they weren't ready for this. they'll tell me when they're ready, you know. But
the main publisher was a woman, of course.
No.
You don't mean leaders of individual religious groups like Mary Baker?
No. But in the Lakota tradition, their tradition is that a sacred woman, white buffalo woman, came. It was about 500 years ago, about the same time as the coming of the white man. But anyway, my first chapter. Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have five sessions, and the first is going to be today on Lao Tzu and Taoism, and then Moses and Judaism. Tomorrow I have a little section on Jesus, because I don't have a whole, since you have everything here on Jesus and Christianity. Now I'll say how they're related. Gautama the Buddha will be the third. Krishna, the avatar, fourth, and Muhammad, the prophet, fifth. Okay. Just going back to that question of the female tradition, there was a period, and there are a lot of books coming out on this recently, about 10,000 years ago to 3,000 years ago, which was kind of the Neolithic era, when the predominant religion was the religion of the goddess, and a number of particularly women scholars are writing books on that. And that doesn't tend to appear very much in comparative religion books yet. is the tape man here? No. If this works, which I have no idea, it will give you a little mood setting with the Taoist music. Ah, here it is. Okay, we're going back to ancient China. Around. here's something on my both books. You want here's the movie. I was up hiking with my wife Margie yesterday up to Heart Lake, and we passed various streams and lakes and so forth. And Taoism is a religion or a form of spirituality very close to nature. There are a lot of I was sure they were going to have the sacred scriptures of all the religions here, so I didn't bring my separate books because they'd be too heavy to carry with all my stuff, and I find they don't. So if I had known that, I would have made up a lot more poems for you. Lao Tzu, let's look at the name. Lao Tzu really isn't a proper name at all. Lao in Chinese means old, and Tzu means something like master or great teacher. So Lao Tzu means old master, and his story is pretty simple and short. So I'll tell you about him. He is said to be a historian in the Chao court. He worked in the archives of the Chao, C-H-O-U, it's spelled, court in ancient China, a period of about 500 B.C. He's about the 500s B.C., which is called, interestingly, the Axial Period, because that was the same time as Gautama the Buddha in India, same time period, and actually the same time as Socrates in ancient Greece. So it was a high power, and of the Upanishads in India as well. So it's kind of a high power spiritual period. So he worked as a pretty unknown historian, and then he went off to the forests, like others, to meditate on the meaning of existence, and he became known somehow, and he finished his meditations, and he was going to leave the country and cross the border to what's present-day Tibet. So he wasn't exactly out to make a name for himself. but the border guard knew about him and wouldn't let him pass. He said, will you set down your thoughts for posterity? I won't let you pass until you do. So he set down his thoughts for posterity in a small book called the Tao Te Ching. Tao Te Ching. I don't know if I have chalk here or not.
There's some up on it. Looks
good. Is there?
Right up there.
Where?
Right here.
This tiny piece?
Yeah, I can get some more if you want to.
Maybe. Tao Te Ching, and that's generally translated the way of life, sometimes translated the way and its virtue. We'll call it the way of life. So he completed his task, you have more of those? Because I, are there any left over of those?
Yeah, you're right.
Here. And then he went off, never to be heard of again. But there is one thing I forgot to mention, and that's a legendary in Chinese history of religion, and that was a meeting before Lao Tzu left town, and that was his legendary meeting with Confucius. Confucius was the other great sage of Chinese religion, who produced what's called Confucianism. He was a younger man at the time, and Lao Tzu may have been by this time in his late 70s or early 80s. He was already an old wise man figure, and Confucius, let's say he was in his late 30s or so, or early 40s, he went out to see the old master, and he asked him about his teaching. Let me read from my book what I have to say there. Okay, the great philosopher and moralist Confucius lived in China of the 6th century BC, 500s, came to Honan province to consult with his contemporary, the old sage Lao Tzu, who was the historian and keeper of the secret archives of the Chao court on matters of ritual, and speak to him about the heroes of old. This is what Lao Tzu had to say to Confucius. All of those of whom you speak long since molded away with their bones. Only their words remain. When a capable man's time comes, he rises. If it does not, then he just wanders wearily around. I have heard that good merchants keep their goods buried deeply to make it look as if they had none, and that a superior man whose character is perfected will feign stupidity. Give up, sir, your many wishes, mannerisms, and extravagant claims. They won't do you any good, sir. That's all I have to tell you. So, that was rather abrupt. Then Confucius went back to his students and said this. Confucius went off and said to his students, I know that birds can fly and fish can swim and beasts can run. Snares can be set for things that run, nets those that swim, and arrows for whatever flies. But dragons, I shall never know how they ride wind and cloud into the sky. Today I saw Lao Tzu. What a dragon. So, that's kind of a tradition in Chinese history of meeting of Confucius and Lao Tzu. And yet, probably Confucius had a greater influence on Chinese society with his morals and rules of behavior, and laws. His is more like a Torah, and Lao Tzu's effect was surely there, but it was for kind of a more mystic type. Lao Tzu's Taoism later kind of conjoined with Buddhism that came to India, I mean to China from India, and produced what's called Chan Buddhism, which is more well known as Zen Buddhism. And Zen Buddhists usually know the Tao Te Ching and so forth. No. I was trying to decide, and you can think about it, whether a Holden village is more Taoist or Confucianist. Maybe there are elements of both. Let me give you some differences between Confucianism and Taoism. The Confucianist stresses learning. He would have you go on to your PhD. The Taoist stresses unlearning. He would say, forget all of that. Go back into nature. A Confucianist cultivates virtuous behavior. Whereas a Taoist, the Taoist ideal is what's called wei, wu, wei, or action of non-action, actionless action, or spontaneous action. The Confucianist stresses communal moral perfection, social rules and customs. The Taoist emphasizes individual freedom and spontaneity. I'm going to read you a series of translations. Really, some say that the Tao Te Ching, which is originally in Chinese of that time, can never be adequately translated, and really can't. But there are various translations available, and I tend to trust the ones of native Chinese scholars who've later learned English. But here are a series of translations of the first line of the Tao Te Ching. Here's one. The Tao that can be told is not the absolute Tao. The Tao that can be told is not the absolute Tao. Okay? Two, the way that can be told is not the unvarying way. Three, the Tao that is the subject of discussion is not the true Tao. Four, the way that may be regarded as the way is other than the permanent way. Four. Five, the flow that can be followed is not the eternal flow. Six, the course that can be discoursed is not the eternal course. I was looking at a book in the bookstore, thinking about theology. That, Lao Tzu said, would not be the thing. Six, seven, the Tao that can be Tao is not the invariable Tao. And eight, this may remind you of the Star Wars, the force that is forced isn't the true force. Remember Obi-Wan Kenobi giving the word to Luke Skywalker, the force be with you, I think. Remember that one? He had the kind of a sword that the light sword that popped up. It's kind of in the samurai tradition. Okay, somebody else volunteer to read this first one. I would like to read that.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
On what you're reading, would that basically be saying then, in our terms, God is incomprehensible, and the God that you can think about is not the true God? Anything which you can comprehend is not the truth.
Yeah.
So that's why the Taoist would be discouraged from thinking, seeking, because that's all just a blind path.
Well, no, he would not be discouraged from seeking, no. But he would not think that something he could think of would be the Tao.
There's a certain, to me, there's a certain element of futility.
Well, let's look to Judaism. The Tetragrammaton, which is sometimes pronounced the Yahweh, for Orthodox Jews, that should never be pronounced, never be said, and it is only said in the tradition by the high priest once a year. In the Ten Commandments, when God said, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other gods before me, thou shalt not make unto thyself any graven image, even of things above or below, that means to me more than a sort of a stone image, it means a thought image, that what you could conceive of, that's not that would be a comparative theology, but that would not be God. The Native Americans, I've heard some speak, say that Wakantaka is not comprehensible. Any attempt to comprehend the Great Spirit is yes, Jeremy.
I was going to say, in Christian theology, people like Paul Tillich and others talk about, you can't talk about the existence of God. God is not a being alongside other beings, or God does not exist, because if he does, then he's one more thing of all things. And so God is thought of as the ground of being, or something of that order. Very similar to this.
Uh-huh. What we're going to talk about tomorrow, the book of the Exodus, God gives his name as the first person of the verb to be, rather than a being among all beings. he is what it is to be. But that's already talking. So maybe I'll read this, and we'll discuss each line separately. We already did the first. I'll say it. Tao can be talked about, but not the eternal Tao. Names can be named, but not the eternal name. Jury had to go somewhere. Anyway. Let's go over there. Tao can be talked about, but not the eternal Tao. Names can be named, but not the eternal name. In Orthodox Judaism, the Hebrew word that's used for God is Ado Shem, which simply is the name. Simply says the name. So, Ado Shem. So, I wanted to point out that whereas for the past hundreds of years, there was kind of a bifurcation between religion and science. Science got more and more away from religion. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, he wrote The Phenomena of Man, the Jesuit priest, predicted there would be a coming convergence between science and religion. That's back in the 1950s, early 50s, when he wrote The Phenomena of Man. And that's already happening at the most advanced levels of science, like the quantum physicists. At the sort of lower levels, biologists and experimental psychologists and sort of tend to hold on to a sort of old-fashioned materialistic view that's really went out of date in the late 19th century, early 20th century. But a couple of books, and there are many, many others that relate to that point, is this The Tao of Physics. He uses the word from Taoism by Fritjof Capra, The Tao of Physics. He's seeing some kind of similarity and unity between the quantum physics and Eastern religions in Taoism and Buddhism and so on. And another one, I haven't read this one yet, which I'm beginning to read, is by Henry Morgenau. He's a famous quantum physicist, called The Mystery of Existence, The Mystery of Existence. And he, his last chapter is called A Universal Mind. He comes to the idea of a universal mind. So there's the beginning of that. What do you think about any other comments on the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao? In fact, I think that the theme of listening to the sacred relates to that. You would better listen to the sacred rather than you say what the sacred is all about. These are just the human words and concepts. Second, as the origin of heaven and earth, it is nameless. As the mother of all things, it is nameable. As the origin of heaven and earth, it is nameless. As the mother of all things, it is nameable. So, as ever hidden, we should look at its inner aspects, essence. As always manifest, we should look at its outer aspects. So as ever hidden, we should look at its inner essence. As always manifest, we should look at its outer aspects. These two flow from the same source, though differently named, and both are called mysteries. The mystery of mysteries is the door of all essence. What he was saying about inner essence and outer aspects, there's another physicist named David Bohm, who was a student of Einstein's, and he has a book that's very much like a scientific book on the Tao called, what's it called? David Bohm, Wholeness and the Implicate Order. Wholeness and the Implicate Order, and he talks about the inner aspect of things, which would include consciousness being the implicate order, and he talks about the explicate order, or what seems out there material.
Could you talk a little more about that second one?
Yeah, I okay. What would you like me to say about that?
Well, explain that a little more.
Okay, I can't say that. I can't. I don't know if I can say anything about it. The mother of all things is nameable. Well, the only thing I can say about that, let me relate that to Jewish mysticism. The Kabbalah is what is a name for Jewish mysticism, and it talks about Shaddai or El Shaddai, which is the great spirit, the spiritual, which is we can't see it, And then it talks about Shekinah, Shekinah. And oddly enough, it has a she. The Shaddai in the Jewish mysticism is the and the she, it's just as a coincidence, Shekinah is really the manifest creation, and that's the feminine aspect. And for the Jewish mystics or the Kabbalists, God is present in all of his creation as the Shekinah, or the feminine aspect. So that might relate to that a little bit. So in the Taoist scriptures too, the mother aspect is more the tangible, the creation, and then there's the he uses in the Tao Te Ching the word father only once, but so the father aspect is the spiritual.
Is it kind of like Father Sky, Mother Earth?
Yeah. The Native Americans, I think, they don't have any conflict between the he, she, or this kind of thing. God is both the Wakantanka, Great Spirit, and the Earth Mother, and both one is to be in harmony with both. So that's about all I can say about the mother aspect is more tangible. And why that's so, I don't know. Does anyone know why that's so? Yes?
I might answer that, but I was just going to say that it seems like if I've read through some of these and others from the Tao, the more I try to understand, the more frustrating.
Yeah.
Consequently, I think that the point is for me that I'm never really going to understand it, because if I think that I do, then I obviously haven't understood it. So it's just there for me to read and to try to comprehend.
Yes, next time, if I have time, the parables of Jesus are very much like that too. In the Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition, particularly the Christian, theologians like to explain things. I suppose they do that because they're paid to do that, and they usually teach. And so, but I don't think that gets at the mystery, really. I think I like the term listening to the sacred gets more at the mystery. That was a good question.
My question, I think, on the second one, sort of related to that, when I was thinking of nameable, when you can name something, you sort of think you can understand it. We've just been talking about how it was not understandable, so I guess that was confusing to me that the mother of all things is nameable, almost like that you can get a handle on that, you can name it and understand it.
Yeah.
The origin of heaven and earth is nameless. I mean, so I guess I have to.
It has more to do with, we don't understand God, or can we worship God, and no one, even scientists, knows what happened before the Big Bang and all. Mm-hmm. there's another book by a scientist whom I heard speak, and he wasn't a particularly religious man. Paul Davies, he's an English physicist, but he has a book called The Mind of God. His physics is getting more and more leading him to that kind of an understanding. And he even says in the end of his book that the mystics probably are the only ones who have a direct contact with what the ultimate reality that others try to talk about or Yes.
Taoism. We're talking about it in terms of a religion, but are we really talking here about something which is philosophical in nature and does not center in on what we would call God?
I would call it a religion because it has to do with, like Reverend Peterson left, with the ultimate concern. And the ultimate concern of the Taoist is to come into harmony with the Tao, which is the ultimate. What you may be saying, I'm not sure, is that the Taoist concept of Tao doesn't seem to be the same as our personal concept of God. Is that what you're saying?
I guess I approach it from the Judeo-Christian tradition of there is a prime mover, going back to that kind of theology, and I'm not finding here anything of a prime mover other than a thought that, kind of a thought process. For example, taking the second one, it raises some interesting things for me. In terms of it saying to me, you cannot put God in a box, but you might be able to talk about the box in which God might be if you could put God in a box.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thought it raises in me. And if you're going back to the Hebrew, once you can name something, you have control over it. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with this. But it seems to keep saying that, to me, that all of this, if you want to get in touch with the ultimate reality, it is beyond your grasp, so why not?
Well, it doesn't say that at all. It doesn't say that at all. It would put you through, if you were a Zen Buddhist, you might be woken up with the loud bells at 3 a.m. and meditate all day long, sitting meditation and walking meditation until 11 p.m. and do that for many years in your attempt to reach enlightenment or come in contact with the Tao. So I think that's a pretty pretty total commitment. Yes, the in general, the Eastern religions are the ultimate is seen more impersonally, is seen, whereas in the so-called Western religions, which are all actually Middle Eastern, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the ultimate is approached through personally. This is probably because of the experiences of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses, and so on. So there's a different approach, one more impersonal and one more personal to the ultimate reality. Okay. I'll read the second one I have there. I think it's a nice one to get a feeling for the Tao. The Tao is like an empty bowl, which in being used can never be filled up. I'll repeat that. The Tao is like an empty bowl, which in being used can never be filled up. Fathomless, it seems to be the origin of all things. It blunts all sharp edges. It unties all tangles. It harmonizes all lights. It unites the whole world into one whole, hidden in the deeps, yet it seems to exist forever. Here's a personal aspect coming up. I do not know whose child it is. It seems to be the common ancestor of all, the father of things. That's the only place where Lao Tzu uses a personal term referring to the Tao. It seems to be the father of things. Okay. fact, that's a kind of a beautiful one to more to meditate on than to talk about. You might get more benefit by meditating on that than talking about it.
To me, the concept of eternity is there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Fathomless, it seems to be the origin of all things. Yet it seems to exist forever. One thing of the six world spiritual teachers in my book, for most of them, there is an account of a key spiritual experience they had. A couple of examples, Moses at the burning bush, which is my favorite Bible story, by the way, and Jesus at the baptism at the River Jordan. There is no account of such a thing for Lao Tzu, and if he had such, he would be too humble to talk about it. There's a great emphasis on humility. Now, let me go on to another, and this may kind of relate to a Judeo-Christian myth or story as well. It's poem 2. This is it. When all the world recognizes beauty as beauty, this in itself is ugliness. When all the world recognizes good as good, this in itself is evil. Indeed, the hidden and the manifest give birth to each other. Difficult and easy complement each other. Long and short exhibit each other. High and low set measure to each other. Voice and sound harmonize each other. Back and front follow each other. Therefore, the sage manages his affairs without ado and spreads his teaching without talking. He denies nothing to the teeming things. He rears them but lays no claim to them. He does his work but sets no store by it. He accomplishes his task but does not dwell upon it. And yet it is just because he does not dwell on it that nobody can ever take it away from him. Start with the first. When all the world recognizes beauty as beauty, this in itself is ugliness. When all the world recognizes good as good, this in itself is evil. What the biblical story does that relate to? Was there a time in the biblical story before a distinction between good and evil, or beautiful and ugly, and so forth?
Creation.
Yeah, remember the Eve and Adam eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which I think in ancient Israel was a fig tree, not an apple tree, but eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, suddenly they were expelled from Eden, in which I see that there's a sort of an original state of unity, and although sort of an unconscious unity, and expelled into the world of opposites out there, of good and evil, of beautiful and ugly, and all the clashing opposites. I think you have most wars take place because one society regards themselves as good and the enemy naturally is evil, and vice versa on the other side. How many of you know a little bit about Jungian psychology, Carl Jung? Jung talks about the ego and the shadow, and the ego is you as you think you are, and the shadow is the side of you that you don't believe exists, but you see it out in your enemy, maybe a collective enemy or maybe a personal enemy, and Serbians versus Bosnian Muslims or whatever the various wars going on all over the world. So this is okay, I have two more very nice ones. This is a key kind of phrase in Taoism, wei wu wei, or action of non-action. And let me read you two, I call them poems for lack of a better name. poem 8, and here he uses the metaphor of water. The highest form of goodness is like water. Water knows how to benefit all things without striving with them. It stays in places loathed by all men. Therefore, it comes near the Tao. Read that. It stays in places loathed by all men. Therefore, it comes near the Tao. In choosing your dwelling, know how to keep to the ground. In cultivating your mind, know how to dive in the hidden deeps. In dealing with others, know how to be gentle and kind. In speaking, know how to keep your words. In governing, know how to maintain order. In transacting business, know how to be efficient. If you do not strive with others, you will be free from blame. Going to the back to the first, the highest form of goodness is like water. Water knows how to benefit all things without striving with them. It stays in places loathed by all men. Therefore, it comes near the Tao. Do you want to comment on that? That made me think of Jesus, who associated with people who were not the people you should associate with for the Orthodox Jews at that time.
It's almost too straightforward for what we've been hearing previously. It seems to make more sense than some of the other things that you read. Especially as you read it after, it almost sounds like a list of rules.
Yeah, that did sound like that. But I like the part, the water knows how to benefit all things without striving with them. It stays in places loathed by all men. Therefore, it comes near the Tao.
Water always goes to the lowest place, lowest path,
wherever it goes. Carl Jung, the great psychiatrist, talks about a discussion with a Hasidic Jew, and he asked him, how come people don't seem to know God anymore, experience God anymore? Mm-hmm. And the Orthodox Jew said, because they don't know how to stoop low enough.
It's sort of like the text that says you see the Christ in the naked and the poor, and the, mm-hmm. when you give a cup of cold water to the one, the Christ is there.
Mm-hmm. Right. You'd be more likely to know Christ there than you would as an academic theologian. You know. is jumping ahead to Christianity. It's interesting that there were scholarly people, the Pharisees and Sadducees and all, but Jesus chose none of them as his disciples except one. All the rest were simple fishermen, and they kind of dealt with lowly things every day. I think who was the one scholar he had as a disciple? That was Judas. Here's another one I like. That was one was about water. This is about softness. Softness. Psalm 43. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. Only nothing can enter into no space. Sounds like quantum physics. Only nothing can enter into no space. Hence I know the advantage of non-doing. Wu Wei. Few things under heaven are as instructive as the lessons of silence, or as beneficial as the fruits of non-doing. Read that again. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. Only nothing can enter into no space. Hence I know the advantages of non-doing. Few things are under heaven are as instructive as the lessons of silence, or as beneficial as the fruits of non-doing. The softness. Water would seem soft, but and a rock hard, but you know in nature that water is breaks down over millions of years, rocks into sand, and a tidal wave will just demolish a town. And even softer than water is air, but air in a concentrated form, Hurricane Andrew, or a tornado that will overcome any hard thing. The air in the form of a tornado. So I don't know what spirit is, I believe in it, but that's even more soft and intangible, and yet that the spiritual teachings say is the strongest, the most powerful thing of all. And I pointed out in my book that men of great power, like Napoleon, Alexander the Great, Napoleon, Hitler, they all ended up more or less destroying others and destroying themselves, and sort of their a wicked evil force set up counterforce that Hitler died in a bunker, a self-inflicted bullet wound. Mussolini was hung by his heels, and Alexander the Great, who conquered the world at that time, died for a pretty young age in a drunken orgy. But then very soft people, very soft words of Jesus, Lao Tzu and so on, Buddha, those soft teachings still live on, spiritual teachings, in the case of the Lao Tzu and Buddha, 2,500 years later, and Jesus, 2,000 years. So I think that's an important one, the power of softness. Yes?
Can you flesh out the business of non-doing?
And how it can have
No, I don't know if I can flesh it out, but there's a thing you've probably seen on TV, or maybe you've seen it in person. That comes from Taoist sources. That's a movement exercise called Tai Chi Chuan. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. And that's very, very soft. Very soft, gentle movement, and I've done it myself for about 20 years, so I consider myself a beginner. But in the hands of a master, the very soft movement seems eventually to energize something called qi, which is sort of the spiritual energy in the Chinese, and a master of that, so he was attacked by someone of the hard form of martial art, kind of elude him a little and give him a very soft touch, and the other guy would be flung about 15 feet away, and that would be a kind of non-doing.
I sort of had a thought when you were reading that about Jesus before Pilate.
Oh, yes.
Pilate asked him
exactly.
What is truth,
yeah.
And Jesus answered with silence.
He answered with that's
and,
perfect.
And even the going to the cross is
yeah.
Sort of the
yeah.
No resistance, but look at the power.
Yeah, that was very Taoist. He answered Pilate, what is truth, with nothing. That would be a non-doing. Thank you. That would be a most powerful form of non-doing, because you can imagine Pilate would be totally nonplussed by that, you know. And any other examples in the life of Jesus?
The strong feeling for that, not that just in the life of Jesus, but sometimes when I'm in planes, I look down, all there is a big cloud bank and you can't see anything down below. And it seems like in some ways, from one perspective, we're not that important. Or So the non-doing to me is kind of realizing our place in nature, and it's much bigger than us. And and sometimes I think we overemphasize what we can do. It's almost like a lot of our life and everything is dependent on things that are set up outside of ourselves. Mm.
I always wonder about the statement of Jesus of resist not evil. That sounds like non-doing. No one has ever really explained that. But there's a story in the Tai Chi legends, and the founder of the Tai Chi was a Taoist monk of about the 13th century AD, of a great old Taoist Tai Chi master, who simply some bandits came to beat him up, and he just let them go ahead and beat him up, and he pretended he was dead, and then they left, and he just got up and walked away because he could absorb all of that. And the next day, several of them died, and several had broken bones, and they were in kind of bad shape. So that was a kind of a non-doing. And the thing about the silence, in the Native American tradition emphasize the value of silence, also Quakers. And I took a 10-day colloquium, and we had one Native American man from Alaska, and he practically said nothing the whole time. He had kind of a very powerful silence, and he became almost the most important person in the group. And when he did speak, everyone listened, and he spoke very little, but so that's softness. he has something about knowing thyself. He who knows others is wise. He who knows himself is enlightened. He who conquers others is strong. He who conquers himself is mighty. He who knows contentment is rich. He who keeps on his course with energy has will. He who does not deviate from his proper place will long endure. He may die.